So there's this really good book called Dare by Barry McDonough, and in it he presents a very unique way of treating panic attacks. It's a really good book, and I suggest you check it out. But he has this really good quote in there that says, "We cannot control the world around us, we can only control our response to it." And I love that quote because it's so true. You know, we have some shred of influence over our lives. We can make positive choices, we can affect change in a small scale in the world in general, but for the most part, we're all just kind of flying around the universe on this crazy rock with our own little lives going on in the context of this broader universe that really is just so random. And I think it's important to recognize that we're all in this together and we're all in the same position where, yes, we can make positive choices, like I said, we can do some things, but we're sort of at the mercy of the randomness of the universe too. So aside from the things that we have control over, it's also important for us to recognize that we should have some influence over the way that we interpret what's happening to us. So rather than focusing so hard on changing the structure of what's happening around us, it can help sometimes to focus more on our interpretation and how we receive what's going on around us. And that's what we're going to talk about a lot today. We're going to be talking heavily about cognitions or thoughts and how those play into anxiety. Anxiety is very heavily influenced by thoughts. Research shows that when somebody is anxious, their thoughts and their attention actually becomes biased towards seeing things as more threatening, seeing things as more anxious. It filters out the stuff that does not support that and instead amplifies the anxious parts of what's going on in their environment. And so in that way, somebody who's anxious actually sees the world in slightly different of a way than somebody who is not anxious. Now, the good thing is we have some degree of control over this. I want to introduce you to a concept that's very central to cognitive behavioral therapy, which is one of the approaches to therapy that I personally really enjoy. And the concept that I'm going to talk about here is called the cognitive triad. So basically, you want to think of a triangle, and at each point, you have a different thing. On one point, you have your thoughts, on one point, you have your feelings, and on one point, you have your behaviors. It's called the cognitive triad. You could also call it the cognitive triangle. I tend to just call it the Triforce because I'm kind of a dork, but it's a really, really central concept to what we're going to talk about here. So, thoughts, feelings, behaviors. That's it. Just kidding. We're going to go into a little bit more here. The concept here is that your thoughts very much influence the way that you feel, and then that in turn affects the way that you behave and what you do. Let's say, for example, you texted your friend and you said, "Hey, you want to go out tonight? There's this new spot that I've been looking at. I know it's been a crazy week, so I'd really love to just get out and, you know, have a couple of drinks and have some fun if you're willing to get together." And they text back, "No, not tonight." Just that, "No, not tonight." That leaves a lot of room for interpretation, right? You don't know why they said that. But whatever you think in your head, whatever your assumptions are about why they said that, is going to have a very different effect on how that makes you feel in the end. If you think there's a positive reason for that, you may not feel so bad. If you think there's a negative reason for that, that may make you feel upset. That may make you feel anxious. That may make you feel mad. Let's say that you assume the worst and you think that this friend is actually upset at you, or they don't like you that much, or something like that. And they're saying, "No, not tonight," because they're just blowing you off and they couldn't give a shit. Well, that's going to make you feel not very good, right? That'll make you feel a lot of different ways. For some people, that's more sad. For other people, that's more upset. Whatever the case may be for you, it's going to make you feel a certain way. And then that in turn is going to make you behave in a certain way. So rather than just saying, "Oh, okay," you might actually like snap back at them and say, "Well, whatever, who cares? I didn't want to invite you anyway. I was just doing it to be nice." Or you might kind of be very short with them. Whatever it is, you're going to react in a certain way that's driven by your interpretation. So you can see kind of how that plays out, right? So you have the event that happened, you have your interpretation of it, that leads you to feel a certain way, and then that feeling causes you to behave in a certain way. That's that cognitive triangle kind of playing out there. If we take this scenario and look at it a little bit differently, maybe you think, okay, it's about, 5 o'clock that I'm texting this. I know my friend works and they're probably driving home from work right now. So maybe they're just trying not to crash their car and they want to be brief. So they say, "No, not tonight." And maybe they'll elaborate later on if I ask them. So that would change your feelings about it probably, right? So if your interpretation of it is not that they're being mean or they don't like you, but it's more that they're just trying to keep themselves safe and they can't really text very much right now, then you'd probably still be bummed that they can't hang out and you have to find somebody else to hang out with or go by yourself, but you're not going to be angry, you're not going to be hurt, you're not going to feel those same negative emotions that come along with this other interpretation. Now, the vital thing to remember here is that we're just taking guesses. In reality, we have no idea why that person texted that. But we often do this with anxiety, where we're here and our emotions jump way over here, right? We have this interpretation about a situation that we don't know if it's true or not. But in the moment, we're going to emotionally react as if it were true. So we kind of emotionally jump the gun, and that's something that happens a lot with anxiety. So with this, we can recognize that our interpretation of what happened is going to have a huge effect on how we feel, and then sometimes that definitely has an effect on the way that you behave towards somebody. And in this case, if you had the more positive interpretation, rather than snapping back and saying, well, whatever, I don't care, you might see something like, oh, okay, well, I hope everything's all right. Let me know if you want to get together next week, or let me know when you can get together. Something that's a little more productive and a little more positive and a little more happy. So in that cognitive behavioral therapy that we talked about, we'll just call it CBT for short so I don't trip over my words too much, which I tend to do. In CBT, you really want to try to install a filter in your brain between the emotional reaction and what you decide to do with your behaviors. And this is really important. Of course, you're allowed to have an intuition. You're allowed to have a gut feeling about things. I don't want to take that from you. But if you're somebody with anxiety, you and your intuition probably aren't totally on good terms. Maybe it helped you out in the past when you needed it to be very kind of anxious and over the top and very suspicious. But now that gets you into trouble. So I want you to kind of install a filter in your brain where there's a space. And again, I just want you to have some space there. It's a pause. You want to put a pause between that input from your amygdala, right? That raw emotion that says you should worry about this, or you should be upset about this, or fearful about this. Put a space between that and what your logical mind decides to do with yourself, what behavior you decide to exhibit. And that's the important thing here. You know, with practice, you can become just a little more suspicious of your automatic thoughts in a situation and install a bit of that filter. And what that does is when you have that space, that buffer between your anxious thought and your behavior, it allows time for your logical mind to kick in. And instead of anxiety deciding what it is that you're gonna do all the time, you get to decide that. Of course, it helps to sort of reduce the amount of anxious thinking that you have and your symptoms and all the stuff we've been talking about. But you don't have to get rid of them entirely. You just need to have enough of that buffer so your frontal lobe, the really logical part of your brain, can say, okay, hold on, let's look at this. Let's see what the evidence is. Let's see, you know, what our interpretation about this is and whether we should believe that, and then make an informed decision about your behavior rather than anxiety saying, okay, we're driving, oh shit, let's go this way, right? Because that's what happens with anxiety. It comes out of nowhere and it just tells you to do something very specific that's not exactly what you were planning. Let's return to the idea of the scientist that we talked about in the journaling section. So adopting that persona of a scientist is a very good thing to do here. I think that pushing yourself to be a better scientist in this context is very helpful because your brain, as I said before, is a terrible scientist. It jumps to conclusions without proper evidence. And so what you can do is you can treat your feelings, treat your interpretations as hypotheses, meaning they're guesses. You don't know that they're true for sure, but they're your guess for right now as to what's going on. So you have this initial guess about what's happening, and you need to look at some evidence to either prove or disprove that. And then with that, then you can decide what you're going to do about the situation. But instead, what our brains do is they get that immediate input, jump to a conclusion, and then let that guide our behavior. So we're trying to slow that down, become more scientific, become better scientists, and look at the evidence of the situation. There's a really simple but awesome exercise that you can do to help this out, and it's called the two-column technique. I'm gonna grab a notebook real quick. Basically, what you do is you simply make two columns on a sheet of paper. So just like this. You put a line straight down the middle. Hopefully your line is a whole lot straighter than mine is. And what you do with that is on one side, you write down evidence that supports your hypothesis, meaning evidence that supports your immediate assumption. So when you text your friend and they text back, no, not tonight, that just little short response, and you feel like they're giving you the shaft, that they don't care about you, that they're mad at you or something like that, you can use a two-column approach to say, okay, what evidence supports that negative assumption? And what evidence might support a more positive interpretation? There's somebody that I work with professionally recently who had a scenario where they were sick. They got sick and they felt like they might need to take some time off of work, but they got really, really worked up about that fact because they were afraid that if they took time off of work, everything was going to go to crap in their team. They thought they were the only one who can keep things together, that if they weren't there to hold everybody's hand through the process, that things were going to go bad and, you know, they might end up losing their job in the long run because things went so sideways. But that was their initial interpretation. That was their initial gut reaction to the situation. And it provides pretty good ground to do this sort of plus or minus evidence for, evidence against two column sheet here, because there's some evidence that does support that, and there's definitely some evidence that may not support that. The thing is, this person, before doing this exercise, they already felt like crap, right? They took their assumption that things were going to go bad. Okay, I'm going to have to take time off work. Everything's going to go to crap. I'm going to come back and it's going to be just this shit storm and it's going to be terrible. And that, even though it's based on something that may or may not be true, that made them feel bad already. They were already anxious. They were already upset. It was also already affecting the way that they were treating people around them. And so that's an example of what I'm saying. We emotionally jump the gun. We go from here all the way over to there and then let that start affecting our behavior. So instead, what we could do is we could break it down using this two-column approach. So what we can do is we can put, if I get sick, things will go downhill at the top. That's this person's anxious assumption. That's their immediate gut feeling. And then there's going to be some evidence for and some evidence against that. A few things that do support that anxious hypothesis. One is that this person was definitely the most tech savvy in their office. So in the projects that needed to be done, they had the most technical knowledge. So they could lead the pack, and other people may not be able to do that with their level of expertise. Another thing that they had that supported their hypothesis was that their team comes to ask them stupid questions all the time. On any given day, someone will knock on their door and they'll say, hey, I have a question about this, when they really should have been able to figure that out for themselves. So that doesn't make him feel very confident in that. And then the team also doesn't always catch their mistakes. So when there is a stupid mistake that happens, sometimes it slides and it leads it up to this person to figure out where that mistake was. So you can go on and on, just do as many as is appropriate, but this is a good place to leave it right here. So those are a few things that do support that anxious hypothesis, that immediate gut reaction that something's going to go wrong. Now let's try to have a balanced perspective and look at a few things that do not support that. So some evidence against. One, this person had been gone from the office before. They'd taken leaves before. They've had to leave for vacations or other things like that, and it was okay. Things weren't ideal, obviously. There's some work to do when they get back, but they're fine. When they get back from their vacation, everything's okay. So there is some evidence to support that actually, looking at the past behavior, things could work out just fine. Another one is that people sometimes just ask dumb questions because they can. If you're available to them, they're going to ask those dumb questions. But given the chance, if you're not there, they might be able to work it out for themselves, which could actually be a positive thing in the long run, in the grand scheme. And then the last one is that, the work that needs to be done in this particular situation, maybe it's not really that technical. Maybe it's something that they could do, even though, yes, you are the one with that much tech savvy. You don't need to perform up here. Maybe it only requires performing right here, even though you up here would, have an easier time with it. So now as you go through that, you tend to get a little bit more of a balanced perspective. It's not just the terrible, anxious, negative thoughts. You're also having some other interpretations. And really not saying any single one of those is right or wrong, because we don't totally know. But what you can do is you can change how confident you feel in your initial reaction. So what I mean by that is actually assign a 0 through 100% to how confident you are that you were correct in your hypothesis. In this case, the hypothesis was that if this person goes off work, everything's going to go to crap. So maybe when they first started this, before they did the two column exercise, they felt 90% certain that was true. But after challenging themselves to go through and look at the evidence for and the evidence against it, maybe it changes a little bit. Maybe it's more of a 60-50%. Maybe it's a 50-50 thing. Maybe it'll go bad, maybe it won't. Perhaps it's even less. That's even better. But either way, if you're able to knock it down from a close to 100% certainty that things are going to be bad or whatever your anxious thought is, down to, something lower, 60, 50, 40, 10, whatever it is, that's going to help you out a bit. That's going to make you feel a little bit less worked up. And that might influence your behavior in a positive way, rather than you doing things that may be counterproductive or not helpful in the situation. The other thing that can be helpful to sort of defuse how scary that negative hypothesis is actually rate also how severe that would be. On a 0 to 100 scale, not necessarily a percentage, but 100 is like the most severe, terrible thing ever, 0 being just fine. You could say, okay, 0 to 100, if this was true, how bad would that be? How screwed would I actually be? Even if this was 100% true, how bad would that be? And oftentimes when you actually assign a numerical value to it, you realize, okay, it could be a bit bad, but it's not as bad as I'm reacting. My reaction to this is not consistent with the number that I see on the page. And that can help you sort of meet in the middle and sort of downregulate and react a little bit less strongly than you were before. We do this with anxiety. We tend to overestimate the likelihood of something bad happening. And when we think about something bad happening, we tend to overstate how severe that would actually be. That's the way anxiety works in our brains, is it overestimates those things and it sees a greater amount of threat. We have a big tendency to sort of inflate the fear and the dangerousness of the thoughts that we have. And of course, that's going to lead you to get pretty worked up, make you feel more anxious. Let's say that it's the holidays and you need to go to the mall to do some shopping. If that's an anxious trigger for you, the being outside in a public area like a mall, you're probably engaging in some of this overestimation, both of the probability and the severity. Like, yes, sometimes there are these markets that are like shoulder to shoulder and it's not even a safe situation. Most of the time, that's not the case though. So when you're thinking about it, you may be very, very much overestimating the probability that you're gonna be in a scenario where you feel like you have no escape, or there's nowhere for you to run to, or it's a scenario where it might not be safe for you. You're overestimating that probability. And then you're gonna also overestimate how severe it would be if something bad were to happen. So maybe your anxious hypothesis, maybe your anxious fear is, I'm gonna go and I'm gonna start having a panic attack. And when I have a panic attack, people are going to notice and they're gonna think that I'm going crazy. I'm gonna have nowhere to run to because it's too packed and there's no places to hide. And someone's gonna call the police on me because they think I'm a crazy person, right? That would be jumping from 0 to 100 in terms of just overestimating that severity. When you have dangerous thinking like this, that's what I like to call just dangerous thinking, that can make you avoid scenarios. You really take a simple situation and blow it up and you go down this rabbit hole. And at the end of that, you talk yourself out of going. So you don't end up going shopping or driving or whatever your particular anxious scenario is. And when you do avoid it, that's not good because that ends up feeding anxiety. Anxiety feeds on avoidance. So when you don't go, your anxiety feels like it kept you safe and it gets stronger and stronger. And so by trying to defuse and make this thinking less dangerous, we can actually stand up to our anxiety a little bit more. To me, the best way of dealing with dangerous thinking and defusing it, making it feel less dangerous, is to actually answer those what-if scenarios and recognize that you always have options. So your worst case scenario, what if? You know, you can actually play that out and answer the question for yourself. We don't usually give ourselves a chance to do that. We think, okay, this might happen, so that means avoid it. Rather than, this might happen, and if that happened, so what? What would that mean? And so if you were to play it out, it can be really helpful. So let's say that you got to the place, you got to the mall or whatever it is, and you felt too scared to get out of the car. That's your what if scenario. What if I get there and I'm too afraid to even get out of the car? Okay, well, what if that happened? Well, you could go home. That's one option. You could just turn around and go right back home. Another option is that you could sit there and take a few deep breaths and see if your body calms down a little bit. You could play a game on your phone or listen to a guided relaxation or an app on your headphones to try to calm yourself down a bit or distract yourself. You could roll the windows down and sort of get acclimated to the sounds. Maybe it's sort of like jumping into a cold pool where you need to ease into it a little bit. And once the sounds start happening and you get used to that, you'll be less sensitive. You can go on, but the point is there are always options there. It's not actually just a one or zero sort of thing. If the worst case scenario happened, what are the options that are there? And when you realize that there are options and it's not a hopeless thing, you're not helpless in this scenario, that usually makes you feel like the thoughts are maybe a little bit less dangerous than they were before. Let's apply this to the panic attack scenario. So let's say you're in the mall and you start having a panic attack. Okay, that's a lot of people's worst case scenarios, but you don't have to stop there. What if that happened? So let's say you're walking through and you're in the middle of a bunch of people and you start getting panic symptoms. Well, you could find a restroom to go to. That's one option. You could sit down on a bench and just breathe for a little bit. You could put on your headphones and walk around or sit down and put on your headphones. You could find a store that's very calm, like a bookstore or a coffee shop or something like that to just get out of the hustle and bustle. Or you could leave. You have options again. I want to stress that you don't need to figure out every possible contingency. You don't need to think of every single what if. The point here is not to make you prepared for anything by having you predict every outcome. The point here is to recognize that no matter what happens, you have options. You're not left without a paddle, right? And that's not gonna take away your anxiety 100%, but what we're hoping to do is just bring it down a few notches to a more manageable level when you realize that even the worst case scenario is not as bad as I was thinking it is. I've been overestimating the probability that that happened, and I've been overestimating the severity of what would happen. And when you look at the options, you look at the fact that you have options in the first place, your anxiety goes doot, 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 and you still have some anxiety because it's not a fun situation, but suddenly you're able to go shop. Suddenly you're able to go drive. You're able to do that thing that you were previously avoiding. And that's very powerful. We're getting one step closer to just kind of taking our lives back from anxiety. And that's very, very good. Sometimes we don't really know why we're so anxious. There's a lot of aspects of it that could be causing anxiety, but really when it comes down to it, like, why is this causing us such anxiety? Why is this such a big deal when we feel like it shouldn't be? There's something deeper underneath there. There's a core at the bottom of this that's probably driving this anxiety. And sometimes that can be helpful to uncover, to really see, okay, why am I blowing this so far out of proportion? In CBT, again, cognitive behavioral therapy, there's a really good exercise called the downward arrow exercise. And you can use that to kind of strip away the layers of BS to get down to that core of what's the real fear here? The question you want to ask yourself for the downward arrow exercise is, what would be so bad about blank? What would be so bad about blank? Let's say that you were going to give a talk at school and you were afraid that you might be nervous and you were anxious about that. What would be so bad about being nervous? Well, my hands might shake. And then you ask yourself again, okay, well, what would be so bad about my hand shaking? Well, then people would know that I'm nervous and that I'm not confident in myself. Okay, well, what would be so bad about people knowing that you're not confident in yourself? Because then they'd be able to hurt me. I'd be vulnerable. Maybe that's the nugget there. Maybe that's the real thing. And you realize that it's not just the presentation. It's not just this. It's not just that. It's that you're fundamentally afraid of being taken advantage of. And you don't want people to know that you are vulnerable. That's powerful information. That may not give you an immediate solution to the scenario, but it can help you sort of get your head on straight and understand that, yes, there's a reason why things are getting a little bit blown out of proportion. And so I really like that exercise, the downward arrow. What would be so bad if? And you can arrange that in a different way. You know, you could use different terminology. You can say, so what if, or whatever. But you just want to repetitively ask yourself that question until you get down and down and down and find that nugget that's really good information for you to work with. Okay, we're gonna cut it for this lesson here. We've gone through a lot of stuff, so I know this was quite information dense. We went through the cognitive triangle, how your thoughts, your feelings, your behaviors interact. When you see a scenario, you have an interpretation of it. That interpretation makes you feel a certain way, and that feeling makes you behave in a certain way. We went through some of the different exercises, the downward arrow to get to the core of your fears, the two-column exercise to be a better scientist and weigh the pros and cons, or the evidence for, the evidence against, and let that give you a little more balance of a perspective. And in the next section, what we're gonna do is we're gonna go into some of the common thinking traps that we all fall into, because there is some consistency there.